Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this issue of our series, we begin with a mini CME experiment in that just days after the annual ASCO meeting in Chicago, I met with Dr. Rogerio Lilienbaum for his instant take on what was presented in lung cancer and what it meant. But we began our conversation by commenting on an email I had received from a listener just that day. I got an email from an oncologist, Dr. Michael Eliff, who says, I find it very confusing to listen to some of your programs which don't have a date on them. He wants them dated. So anyhow, you and I know today is Friday, June the 7th,
yes,
Dr. Eliff. And we're talking, it's a few days since ASCO, and we're going to talk about what happened at ASCO in terms of lung cancer.
Yes.
Any global take about this year in lung cancer at ASCO?
Yeah, I didn't think it was a particularly fruitful year for lung and ASCO. I think we heard some exciting things about immunotherapy. I think we had some interesting data about acquired resistance and agents that can overcome acquired resistance in different mutated patients, but not a whole lot more that would immediately change practice.
So that's kind of funny because I beg to differ.
Okay.
I thought it was really cool. I thought there's some really good stuff. And of course, I'm looking at other things like colon and breast, which there's a lot less of than lung. So I thought actually lung was pretty good, but let's kind of get into some of it. Most of the really cool stuff this year, like you say, was immunotherapy or targeted therapy. But there were a couple of, I thought, really relevant sort of general kind of old kind of chemo type presentations, radiation presentations. To me, one of the most interesting things I've seen in a long time in terms of interdisciplinary care was the RTOG study that Dr. Bradley presented. I know kind of the data's been out there a little bit, but I don't know. I hadn't seen it quite presented like this, and I thought it was pretty interesting. You want to go through that?
Absolutely. So RTOG-0617 is actually a fascinating trial. And it's one of those trials that you really have to appreciate the relevance of the cooperative groups, because it's a question that needed to be addressed, and it had to be addressed by that sort of mechanism. So this was a trial that looked at standard dose radiation for unresectable stage 3 patients with non-small cell lung cancer versus high dose radiation therapy based on some very interesting and exciting phase 2 data from UNC, University of Michigan, RTOG, showing that higher doses of thoracic radiotherapy would be or could be beneficial.
So this study compared 60 to 74 gray of radiation therapy, and this is with chemotherapy.
All of this was given in conjunction with the chemo template. And the chemo template that was chosen for this study was weekly carboplatin paclitaxel, followed by two cycles of consolidation carboplatin paclitaxel.
And of course, the other question that this trial asked that they haven't reported on yet is cetuximab.
Exactly, which was actually added after the trial was activated and was based on the head and neck cancer data and was based on preliminary work that George Blumenschein had done for RTOG with cetuximab in stage 3 disease.
So before you talk about the main finding, which I thought was pretty surprising, do we know right now what's going on in practice? Are people using lower or higher doses right now in practice?
So I think most people are still using something like 63 to 66 gray. You know, being an ex-CALGB member, we sort of focused on 66. A lot of folks in the community use 63, and people still use 60. I don't believe that many people use 74 outside of a clinical trial.
And it turns out that's a good thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Because bottom line is that arm did not look good.
It not only did not show benefit, but it was actually inferior to the control arm.
I mean, if that had been a treatment, we'd have gone, oh, hey, that worked.
Absolutely.
That was kind of scary, though.
Yes.
I mean, worse survival, easy to see on the curves.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, they tried to get into why, and there's a lot of potential reasons. What was your overall take?
Yeah, so I think it's not clear that we have one culprit for this. You know, so some of it might be toxicity, and including unreported toxicity. You know, that's not clear from the study. It could have been, what was incredibly surprising, was worse local control with the high dose arm, something you would not consider intuitive, correct? And so I think there's some issues that are not clear. It may have been something related to an interaction between cetuximab and high dose radiation that we don't know about. You know, so there are some possibilities and hypotheses that we have to wait for the full data to come back.
Right. That came out in the discussion about the cetuximab. Since half the patients got it, maybe that half had more toxicity?
It could have been. I actually treated some patients on this study. And I recall two patients that were randomized to the high dose arm with cetuximab. And it wasn't easy. You know, they both got through that treatment, but it wasn't easy, and they had substantial toxicities. And I, again, it's anecdotal. I didn't have a large sample size in my own practice, but it was enough for me to feel that it was somewhat different than what I would expect, you know, without the cetuximab and without the high dose.
Right, and there was a great discussion afterwards, and the discussant went through a number of different possibilities, but towards the end, she kind of focused in on maybe cardiorespiratory toxicity. I mean, there were more deaths. This wasn't, you know, superficial kinds of toxicities. I guess we don't really know. I guess the bottom line is, I mean, if there are any people doing high-dose therapy out there, maybe it shouldn't be done right now.
Well, if there's anybody doing this right now, they have to stop today. This is a clear message from this trial. 60 gray is a standard treatment for unresectable stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer patients with whichever chemo template you choose to have. I don't think that this is unique to the chemo template that was chosen for this trial.
You know, this year, I think there's a lot more interesting stuff in the metastatic session, but there was one other presentation in the local treatment section, and I wanted to get your take on that. Jean-Charles Soraya, a very colorful investigator, presented, and I heard him talk about this trial a long time before, the TASTE study. And maybe you can just briefly talk about what they looked at and reported here.
So the TASTE trial was a customized adjuvant trial in which patients were tested for EGFR mutation and then ERCC1 overexpression. And they had a phase two feasibility component to that trial, which is what Jean-Charles reported on and realized at the end, very much to everybody's surprise also, that the ERCC1 assay that they were using, the IHC assay, was just not reliable enough to be used in a prospective phase three trial. They actually did something very unique. They went back to the YALT ERCC1, you know, analysis and verified that a lot of patients actually changed from positive to negative, which is alarming in many ways. And this is very much like the RTOG in some ways of how early or how late people jump into new treatments in clinical practice. You know, there was enough perhaps for 74 gray for people to use in clinical practice, and here we have an inferior treatment. And the same thing, I saw more than a handful of patients who received recommendations for adjuvant chemo based on ERCC1 status in clinical practice. So I think that that was the message from Jean-Charles, that at this point, we cannot do this. And it's not just in the adjuvant setting. If you recall Bepler's presentation in the advanced disease setting based on ERCC1 and RRM1, so platinum and gemcitabine interactions, the trial was unequivocally negative. I don't know exactly what Dr. Bepler meant by false negative in a clinical trial, as he concluded. I think for most people in the audience, that trial was a true negative in the sense that directed or treatment directed by ERCC1 status or RRM1 status was no better than the control arm.
Yeah, and actually in the discussion, Alicia Sequist talked about the problems with the ERCC1 antibody. It's an IHC test. So kind of reminds me of Ki-67 in breast cancer. People are now really questioning, you know, whether it's reproducible, whether it's accurate. It sounds like ERCC1's kind of out the door for the moment.
I think so.
But the other thing that I thought was really interesting in the trial that was presented, the adjuvant trial, was it was kind of a cool idea trying to tailor the therapy.
Yes.
You know, unfortunately, the assay didn't work. But the control arm was, quote, standard therapy.
Yes.
And they happened to choose CIS-PEM.
Yes.
And because the other thing they brought out is what they saw in those patients. Because, you know, there's been more CIS-PEM being used, I think, in the adjuvant setting, at least in the United States, and with the idea that maybe it's better tolerated, people get more therapy in. You had the TREAT trial that had looked at this question. And this was kind of recycling the same question. It seemed like what they saw was similar to what was seen in TREAT.
Yeah, I think one important finding that they reported on that study was that more than 80% of patients were able to actually complete four cycles of treatment, which we did not see with the original adjuvant trials using different cisplatin-based combinations. And the same as in the TREAT study, when it was compared to cisplatin-vinorelbine. So I think CISPEM is really emerging as the adjuvant regimen of choice for non-squamous patients.
Yeah, I'm really curious because we have our surveys where we ask people what they do, but you know, I was asking Heather Wakely, I know you participated in the ECOG trial,
yes.
You know, chemo plus or minus bev, but you get to choose four doublets. Mm-hmm. And they had reported, you guys had reported at ASCO a year before what people were choosing, but you couldn't really figure it out because there were squamous patients in there. What I want to know is, what have people given in adjuvant therapy for adenocarcinoma? So I asked her during ASCO, I saw her, and I said, do you have any numbers on what is going on in the trial just in adeno mm-hmm. versus squamous? She said, no.
No.
They haven't looked at it yet. But I think when they look at it, they're going to see a lot of CISPEM and adeno.
Without a doubt. In fact, when they reported the usage of the different regimens, remember, CISPEM was added late on, you know, to that trial.
Right.
It wasn't at the beginning.
Right.
It was only after a while. So they didn't have a lot of patients on CISPEM.
Right.
There's no question that at the end of that trial, for non-squamous patients, I would be shocked if CISPEM is not the most frequently used regimen.
Yeah, you know. I think so too. So you said it was sort of a humdrum ASCO, but hey, anti-PD-L1,
yes.
That was like, came off the,
yeah.
You know, so your guy, Roy Herbst, presented
yes.
a big, I guess, phase 1-2 study. You know, it kind of reminds me of the anti-PD-1 last year. And then David Spiegel from Sarah Cannon presented just the lung stuff in the oral session and, you know, let's talk about it.
So this is incredibly exciting. I mean, just the whole field of immunotherapy, how it's evolving, and the difference that it's likely to make in the lives of patients for whom actually there was really nothing new going on besides, you know, targeted agents.
Squamous cell cancer.
Absolutely.
Squamous cell cancer.
I mean,
it
is unbelievable. So, yes, so Roy Herbst, a colleague of ours, you know, from Yale, presented the overall phase 1 results, and then Dave Spiegel, also a colleague of ours because of the collaboration between Yale and Sarah Cannon, presented the lung-focused results, and it was quite dramatic.
So before we go into the specifics, both of them kind of at the beginning showed some of these diagrams, which, you know, usually I can't follow any of these things, but the one thing I kind of was able to get out of it is anti-PD-L1 is different than anti-PD-1. Which we saw about last year, mm-hmm. in terms of the specificity of where it interacts with the immune system, and maybe could explain some differences, at least indirectly, between anti-PD-L1 and anti-PD-1, at least at this point. In any event, bottom line was they saw some responses.
So that's very interesting, and there was some discussion about this, is whether or not there are differences between, clinical differences, between anti-PD-L1 and anti-PD-1. And it's hard to say at this point. I think the studies are relatively early. There may be, however, some differences in toxicity.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
You know, you look at
Yeah, we did see some pneumonitis in the anti-PD-1 trials, and not a lot, you know, of pneumonitis, maybe one case in an anti-PD-L1 trial. So I think there may be a more favorable toxicity profile in favor of anti-PD-L1, which is, again, an antibody against the ligand and not the receptor. So that may have some implications as to the mechanism of action.
So any specific data points in this presentation you wanted to comment on?
So a couple of things about the efficacy. But before I get to that, let me talk about the toxicity, which is another remarkable feature of these drugs. You just don't see a lot of toxicity.
Although with ipilimumab, that was a little more problematic.
Ipilimumab is different. You know, it's
right.
a different checkpoint, you know, so to speak, is
right.
CTLA-4. And so it's a little bit different mechanism of action. And I think it's fair to say that you should expect more toxicity with ipi that you see with these agents. But, you know, there was no MTD. If this was a dose-finding study
right.
to some extent, then there was no MTD reached.
Right.
No grade 5 events. You know, again, in heavily pretreated patients. So I think that's an important note. You know, we have this idea that perhaps immunotherapy should be best used in very selected patients with excellent performance status and no other major issues. And I don't think that that's what the data has shown so far.
Although, you know, it seems like at least in terms of anti-PD-L1, they're more focused in on trying to get a predictor, you know, the PD-L1 ligand. And I think there was reference to maybe even though they saw responses without it, maybe that was going to be part of future trials?
So the overall response rate was 22%, you know, for the 52 patients with non-small cell lung cancer, both histologies, as you pointed out, you know, adeno and squamous, which is quite remarkable. But there was a significant difference in response rate between those that expressed, you know, PD-L1 versus those who didn't. And that difference was 80% versus 14%. So the question moving forward with these agents is, should we use these drugs only for PD-L1 positive patients? And by the way, another presentation at ASCO was how you test. And in fact, there was an IHC assay that was presented, and it's the one that's going to be used for the future development of this particular drug. Having said that, 14% response rate in those who do not express PD-L1 and have received 3 or 4 previous regimens is nothing to be ashamed about.
Particularly consider the alternatives.
Absolutely.
Being not many.
Exactly. You know, so some of the trials moving forward with PD-1 and PD-L1 are restricted to PD-L1 positive patients. So the one that we have at Yale that's about to open now in a few more weeks will be only for PD-L1 positive patients. Other trials are not restricting to PD-L1 positive patients.
So in terms of the types of trials, for example, at Yale, I know there are trials in a lot of places, but what tumor types, just lung or others?
So now we're going to be able to focus more on lungs. So based on this initial experience, there's going to be phase 2 trials in different diseases. And the one that I was referring to is a lung cancer trial.
What about just a, you know, pan-tumor PD-L1 ligand positive trial, you know, based more on the marker rather than the tumor?
I don't know that this is in the plans right now. I think that based on this very large phase 1 study, the idea is that this is a drug that most likely works best for those who express the marker. I think that it would be just as reasonable to look at this drug in those who do not express because of the lack of options for these patients.
And I know there were, I mean, you know, renal and melanoma and lungs gotten a lot of the attention, but I know Roy presented, I think there was a gastric patient in his phase 1 study,
yes.
Responded, other tumor types.
I mean, PD-L1 is expressed in colon, in
right.
Melanoma, in renal cancer, I mean, in other tumors as well. And that observation of the difference between PD-L1 positive versus negative patients, for example, doesn't seem to be so obvious in other tumor types. So I just think we need to be a little careful so that we don't exclude patients that could potentially benefit from the treatment.
You know, it's funny, in the past when we've talked about new agents, it kind of like is sort of in the back of a lot of people's mind, but now so many things, we talk about them and then a few months later they're approved. Mm-hmm. You know, carfilzomib and pomalidomide and myeloma, and then all of a sudden they're
yes.
here.
Yes.
And I'm, you know, kind of wondering, seeing some of those CAT scans, whether these agents are going to be around sooner rather than later.
So I think that this is going to be much more expedited than the typical course for approval. Having said that, you know, Bristol Myers, for example, did move on with 2 phase 3 studies of their PD-1 agent in non-small cell lung cancer second line, one for adeno and one for squamous cell patients.
Of course, we saw the IPI plus anti-PD-1 data in mm-hmm. melanoma. That's mm-hmm. a whole other story, combination yeah. therapy. But let's move on to, again, you're saying it wasn't that exciting. I'm going to tell you another thing that really completely blew my mind was the BRAF thing.
Yes.
I mean, the dabrafenib thing, that was like, whoa, I was not expecting that.
Yes, yes.
What happened there?
So what's interesting about the trial is, so BRAF is not a common mutation in non-small cell lung cancer, certainly not as common as you see in melanoma, for example. So I think the numbers vary between 1% and 2%
right.
in non-small cell.
But still, and like half of ALK. ALK's only
no, absolutely.
3.5%.
Yes. Yeah, about 4%, right. Maybe a little higher than that sometimes, depending on the population. But no, so it's a legitimate target.
Of course, the denominator is, what, 160,000 or whatever.
And that's the point. So you probably have more, you know, just as many BRAF positive patients as you have CML patients,
right.
Perhaps, you
right.
know, diagnosed every year
or
in the United States.
Mutations.
Or HER2 mutations,
right.
Correct. And so another interesting feature of the BRAF mutation story in non-small cell lung cancer is that, you know, unlike melanoma, in which the majority were V600E mutations, that was not the case with non-small cell lung cancer, in which about 50% perhaps, you know, really are the V600E mutations. Having said that, again, it's an important segment or subset of patients. And up until now, you know, the jury was out. You know, there was a study of emurafenib when colorectal patients with BRAF-positive disease. It was a negative trial.
Although they had BRAF and MEK
at lung and colon, and
exactly.
That's starting to look like it has.
Yes.
And get around the other circuit or whatever pathway. Or,
but it didn't seem like you could just go across tumor
totally.
Types
yeah,
in
it
the
was
beginning
like everybody,
and
yeah.
just focus on the mutation.
Yeah, once
correct.
The colon stuff came out, like the whole next gen sequencing, everybody's like, maybe we can't do this.
Exactly.
And then this paper comes up.
And then
up.
This paper. So this is a paper that was a phase two study of the brafenib in patients with non-small cell lung cancer and V600E mutations. And what they found in 20 patients that were eligible for and available for response, there were 25 that were actually accessible for toxicity, was a significant response rate. So using a dose of 150 milligrams twice a day, they found no significant toxicity, or the same toxicity that you would expect with these agents.
It wasn't anything. Some squamous cancers.
Exactly.
Maybe,
right? And it wasn't anything unique in non-small cell lung cancer patients. And then they saw a 40% response rate in this population.
Well, plus that waterfall plot looks like melanoma.
Unbelievable. Absolutely.
Looks like melanoma. It's like everything's going down.
Everything is going in that direction. So very promising. I think this is an observation that needs to be expanded. I think that going back to the point you made a few minutes ago, this is probably one of the pathways that will be expedited in many ways. You know, immunotherapy is a little bit more complicated because you have different agents, different targets. This is a very specific target. You know how to identify it, and the drug is effective. So I believe that this is going to be another weapon, so to speak, in our armamentarium pretty quickly.
I mean, I'd say maybe it gets added to the list of targetable mutations at this point.
I do believe so.
It's another one to add to the list.
Yes.
And I guess, do we know that much in terms of duration of response at this point?
So the responses were quite durable. Many of the patients are still on treatment. Some of them are on treatment more than 6 months, and even a few of them more than 12 months on treatment.
So really thought-provoking paper.
This was very important.
I thought it was very cool.
Yeah.
So, another paper I wanted to ask you about was, getting into this topic now, mutations and more traditional mutations that are 2 or 3 years old at this point. I had a really interesting presentation in the so-called Biomarker France study. It kind of reminded me of what Mark Criss had presented at ASCO a couple of years ago that was done in the United States. But in this French thing, they had like 10,000 specimens.
Yes.
Can you talk about what they did there?
So I think what the French have been able to accomplish is nothing short of extraordinary. And I think it does show in sort of a global view, what an organized and cohesive healthcare system can provide to their patients. So they were able to test 10,000 patients from all over the country and identify mutations in vast majority of those samples. Over 9,900 of those patients had samples that were usable, for a mutation analysis.
In other words, enough time for
exactly.
them to make decisions.
Absolutely. And then the decisions or the results were informed back to the physicians. They entered all the demographics on each patient. So now they have a database of demographics and mutations and the treatments that these individuals received. So an extraordinary effort, I believe. Do they have clinical trials, as was reported a couple of years ago here from Mark Criss and the Lung Cancer Mutation Consortium? They don't have as many clinical trials for each subset of the mutations that were identified, but there's no doubt they're going to be there, and they're going to get to that point pretty quickly.
The other thing that was interesting is everybody's putting pie charts up nowadays of the different mutations and what their frequency is. And when I first saw those French pie charts, I was like, I almost thought I was looking at the U.S. things. It looked like similar frequency.
Pretty much. I mean, the EGFR mutation was a little less, it was 10% or so instead of the traditional 15% that you would expect. KRAS was perhaps a little bit higher, but about
still
the same.
Around a quarter.
Exactly. Around 25%. Same for ALK, same for HER2, same for BRAF, and those are the ones that they tested.
Yeah, I mean, you really wonder if this is the infrastructure we're going to be looking at in a couple of years. Like, this is maybe going to be sort of practice.
It should be practice. I don't know that we have right now the infrastructure to do this.
Yeah, no.
Not in the United States.
Yeah, no, but I mean, theoretically, the idea would be people get genotyped. Most of them are going to be eligible mainly for trials.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to have,
exactly.
Standard therapy for every single thing, but that kind of system seems like makes sense.
So I think what this trial does is really it expands the observations that we have seen for the past decade from individual patients to your entire population. I mean, that's what this trial really says. It's possible to do this for every single lung cancer patient diagnosed in our country. And that's quite remarkable, I think.
Yeah, really interesting. So maybe we can do our mini Alice Shaw Journal Club here a little bit. As always, she has some pretty good stuff on mutations, and particularly she had a presentation of a new ALK inhibitor, LDK378, which was very interesting. And then she had another paper on the ROS1 and crizotinib. What about those two?
So ALK is an actionable mutation present in 4 to 7% of our patients, as we discussed. And we have an agent that's quite active, you know, for those patients, crizotinib. However, most of these patients, or every one of these patients, eventually will develop resistance. So what Alice did is she tested, along with her colleagues, a different agent, LDK378, which is effective both in preclinical studies, and now this is the first clinical trial of some robustness that she demonstrated that this agent is also active in patients who were resistant to crizotinib. And this was an incredible observation, because this was not 10, 15, 20% response rate. I mean, this was 60% response rate in patients who had been previously exposed to crizotinib.
And, you know, the familiar kind of waterfall plot that we see when stuff works, like everything's kind of going down. A lot of them are partial responses. But again, these are people resistant to crizotinib.
Absolutely. So right now, we don't have an option for these patients besides just conventional chemotherapy. So this agent, you know, expands on the fact that you can continue to treat these patients with targeted agents and not necessarily move to traditional chemo. What's also interesting about this trial is that she was able, in a subset of these patients, to identify, you know, the mechanisms of resistance. And then, in fact, even one particular mutation which functions sort of as the gatekeeper mutation, very much akin to what T790M is for EGFR mutated lung cancer. And the drug was active against patients who developed that mutation, L1196.
I call it the ponatinib of ALK. Anyhow, you know, another thing that kind of bothers me about this is the infrequency, but yet importance of this situation. We did a satellite meeting on Friday night at ASCO on lung cancer. We had five very busy docs in practice, and we tried to get some crizotinib cases. Mm-hmm. Well, we had one case among the five. So, I mean, you know, it's not that common to see this in practice. And so it was interesting, because with that one case, the doc, Dr. Linda Ferris, and Ross Camage and I got on the phone, and we were talking. So this patient, 43 years old, presented, you know, horrendous situation, initially got chemo, then they found he was ALK positive, put him on crizotinib, now he's doing fantastic. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I think, more than 8 months out. And so, you know, she's a happy doc, he's a happy patient, and I'm thinking in the back of my mind, well, what's going to happen next? And, you know, it's fine to put somebody like that on chemotherapy, but if I'm a 43-year-old person who's on crizotinib for ALK, I want to be having my eyes on a study of LDK.
Absolutely. I think without a doubt. And I think this is going to be another one of these drugs that we will see available to us sooner rather than later.
And again, I know it's kind of, you know, these analogies, but I know docs in practice, you know, sort of think about this, but just like ponatinib, again, is hitting mutations that in CML, you know, imatinib and dasatinib and nilotinib don't hit, they're talking about moving it up front. I would think that LDK, they'd be thinking about up front.
Well, actually, this trial included some crizotinib naive patients.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
it did. And they did see excellent activity in those patients as well. So there's no doubt that this is an important agent, an important step towards the treatment of ALK-positive patients.
So I don't know if it's going to just happen over the next few years that we keep picking out 2% here and all, you know, how that's really going to work out in the future. But there's Ross out there, and she presented on ROS1 and crizotinib. You want to talk about that?
So Ross is really hard. You know, you talked about how, you know, infrequent ALK-positive patients, you know, can be in clinical practice. You know, I before I left Miami, I was testing pretty much everyone for ROS that did not have EGFR ALK. And I think I was about 60 to 80 patients that I had tested, and I had not found a single patient with ROS.
Hmm.
So I guess you have to get to 100 to find that 1%, right?
Wow.
You know, that one patient that will be ROS positive. But I think what's the beauty behind ROS1 is again, the fact that you have an active agent that works for ROS1 positive patients. It seems to have the same activity in ROS1 that it has in ALK-positive patients. It's a little tricky, however, to get this drug in clinical practice for ROS1 positive. You know, so in clinical practice.
In terms of getting paid for?
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. So I think this is something that we have to be aware of. You know, we have these data, and yet, you know, it's incredibly complicated and difficult for patients and institutions, you know, to make this drug available for patients with ROS1.
Well, I mean, it's great that she presented a bunch of patients, but, you know, she had me at that one patient that was in the JCO, the first paper in the JCO. They had one patient in there.
Yes.
They had a set of scans before and after with just crizotinib, and, you know, the patient had huge disease that went away.
And it's one of those scans that, you know, it sort of tells the whole story.
I mean, how many do you need
to see
to want to get paid for
Absolutely.
It? You know? But
Absolutely.
On the other, so again, do you want to talk about what you saw? Again, it seemed like a typical everything kind of going down type situation.
Yeah. So what Ellis reported for ROS1 patients, she reported on 15 patients, 14 of those were available for response, and the response rate was nearly 60% again. We seem to be on the 60% range. We saw the same for crizotinib and ALK, LDK for crizotinib resistant,
ALK-positive. The rest.
Exactly.
Shrinking.
Yes.
Just not quite making it to
I think
a PR.
It's a good point. I know this is important to emphasize that it's not just resist or objective response rate. Most of these patients had a benefit. And we're not even talking about disease control rate. We're not even talking about duration of stable disease, for example, which is another important endpoint, you know, for these patients. So this is, I think, the second time that we see this observation. It confirms the activity of the drug. This is another actionable mutation, you know, very much like you said, for BRAF. You know, this is something that we need to be doing for our patients.
So maybe we can finish out talking about the thing nobody wants to talk about, which is what I think I like the term pan wild type disease,
okay.
So to speak.
Yeah, I like that.
I mean, that's a lot of patients, unfortunately.
Yes.
They don't have these mutations. And there were a couple of things that were presented at ASCO I found really interesting. And the one that really surprised me, because I've heard about VIR-STRAT for a while. I've been kind of trying to figure out what it means and where it's heading. And it's this serum proteomic assay. And bang, now they've got a phase 3 study being presented at ASCO. Maybe you can talk about what they saw, because I thought it was pretty interesting.
You know, the trial was actually eagerly awaited, because this trial has been available, you know, to clinicians for a long time. They didn't have, you know, good phase 3 data. Most of the data that they had was retrospective data, BR21, et cetera. So I think that this really sort of shows where the test can be utilized. So this is, as you said, a serum proteomic signature that was developed way back between Colorado and Dave Carbone investigators. And what they are able to do with that information is divide non-small cell lung cancer patients of all histologies into VIR-STRAT good and VIR-STRAT poor. And the division is about 65% and 35%. It's pretty consistent in all the clinical trials as well as in clinical practice. And the contention was maybe VIR-STRAT could predict those individuals, and this is an important point, who would benefit from erlotinib. You know, so if you were
despite not having a mutation.
Exactly. So this is all regardless of mutation status. And assuming that the mutation patients are, in a way, all treated, you know, with erlotinib in the first place. So this trial was a second-line trial. Patients all had their VIR-STRAT status determined upon registration. The investigators and patients were blinded to the results, and then they were randomized to either chemo, pemetrexed or docetaxel, or erlotinib in the other arm. And what they saw was a couple of things. One is the test is prognostic. So VIR-STRAT good patients did much better than VIR-STRAT poor patients. And we knew this already. I mean, nobody questioned the prognostic, you know, value of that test.
Although I guess we should qualify that good still is not that great.
No, it's not that great.
But a little better.
A little better than the VIR-STRAT poor. And then what they saw was within the category of VIR-STRAT good patients, you know, the majority of the patients, there was no difference between chemo and erlotinib. However, when you looked at the VIR-STRAT poor patients, those patients did much better with chemo than they did with erlotinib. So how do you use this in clinical practice? So it wasn't so much what I believe the initial intent of this test was, and that was to, again, identify patients who would potentially benefit from erlotinib. What this test does is it identifies patients who are not likely to benefit from erlotinib in the second line setting. So if doctors are asking, how do I use this test in my practice, is if they're facing a patient, in the second line setting, and they have to decide between erlotinib and chemo, they can order the test. It comes back within 48, 72 hours.
It's a blood test.
It's a blood test, and it's well done. It's rapidly reported.
It's proteomics also,
exactly.
Right? And it's like totally empiric, or is there any reason?
Well, that's one of the things that came out of that discussion is that we don't really know what those proteins, you know, actually mean. So there's 8 peaks, you know, in that signature. If you have them, you're poor. If you don't have them, then you're good. And we don't know what the function of those proteins
are. Although, you know, when you look at the genomic tests and they go, well, yeah, these are proliferation, these are apoptosis, yeah. I still kind of wonder if it's kind of becoming empiric in the long run that you have to validate it, et cetera. But to me, it looked like this trial, it was done in Italy, which
yes.
is interesting.
Yes.
It looked like it was done very rigorously.
I think it was a well-done trial, and I think that it does show that it has predictive value, but again, it has a negative predictive value in the sense that it identifies patients that probably should not be treated with erlotinib.
I thought if people buy into that this is for real, what they saw in this mm-hmm. trial, I thought it was very practical. You know, Dr. Stephen Vogel, who always, you know, shows up at sessions and asks all these great questions, so he decided to hit the lung session. I saw him in a myelofibrosis section he was asked, CML, et cetera. But anyhow, he brought up the question about, well, why do you need something like this? Just give everybody chemo.
Yes.
And I thought the discussant was very eloquent when she went into the fact that, you know, if you basically can say that something like erlotinib isn't going to cause about the same efficacy as, you know, say, docetaxel, then that's a pretty big difference to mm-hmm. a patient. You know, erlotinib may not be a walk in the park, but mm-hmm. certainly has different spectrum of toxicity, oral versus IV. You know, it gives patients an option, and that's 65-70% of these patients, a yes. lot of patients.
So it's interesting because this comes in the midst of an important discussion, which I didn't foresee a couple of years ago. You know, second line therapy was kind of a sleepy field of research. And now this whole idea of, you know, what do you do in second line? Chemo versus, you know, erlotinib, for example. You know, there was a Delta presentation, a Japanese trial that was presented at this ASCO. And then the Italian study that was presented last year looking at wild type patients, right? You know, so what happens, forget the mutated patients, but just on the wild type patients, what do you do in second line? Do you do chemo? Does erlotinib even work for those patients? And even though none of those trials were really conclusive in the sense that the chemo was clearly superior to erlotinib, all of them showed the same trend in favor of chemo. All of them showed the same trend. In fact, the hazard ratios are actually pretty comparable among INTEREST, TITAN, the Italian trial, and now the Japanese trial. So I think Vogel's point was, we're moving into using chemo in second line anyway, right? You know, so how does this test, you know, play into that equation? It was an important point.
But again, if you can identify the 70% of patients where it's not going to make a difference, I mean, to me, from a patient quality of life point of view, it's pretty different to take erlotinib compared to get IV chemo. I mean, I guess there are patients who would prefer IV chemo, but I don't know. I don't think that many.
I think you have at least an option.
You know, do you use erlotinib in wild-type patients?
I do, and I have to admit I use less than I use chemo in that setting, and I think it is an individual preference. The beauty here is that you can offer it as an option. You know for a fact that they're comparable in that setting, and you're not offering an inferior treatment.
Another cool paper, I'm telling you. I think this is good. See, you don't have the perspective.
You're convincing me, Neil.
You know, you didn't see what was going on in, you know, breast cancer, which was,
exactly.
I wish there had been more this year. But anyhow, although there is a lot going on in breast cancer, let's finish out talking about, there were a couple other papers presented, getting again into wild-type disease primarily, looking at BEV combinations, you know, the Point Break data getting presented again. Basically, I guess there were two trials that addressed these issues. Can you go through what they looked at and where you think it all comes together?
So the first trial was presented by Ralph Zinner from MD Anderson, and this was a phase 3 study called PRONOUNCE. And non-squamous patients, first line, were randomized to either carboplatin pemetrexed with pemetrexed maintenance or the ECOG 4599 regimen, which is carboplatin paclitaxel and BEV with BEV maintenance. It was a relatively small study for a phase 3 study, and it had an interesting, if not peculiar, primary endpoint called grade 4 progression-free survival. You know, so basically survival free of progression or death, but also free of grade 4 events. And this is, to my knowledge, an endpoint that, you know, had not been used very often or even validated in major trials, but that's the endpoint that the investigators chose. And the bottom line here is there was no difference. There was no difference between those two regimens. I don't know how you put this into perspective. I guess you can say, if you choose not to use a Bev-containing regimen and you just want to use carboplatin and pemetrexed followed by PEM, you can do that. On the other hand, the toxicity profile, at least with respect to hematologic toxicity, was not that much more favorable for carbo-PEM compared to carbo-paclitaxel and Bev. In fact, anemia and thrombocytopenia were worse on the carbo-PEM arm versus the carbo-paclitaxel. Of course, neutropenia was worse on the Bev arm, as you would expect. Alopecia, peripheral neuropathy were significantly worse on the paclitaxel arm. So I was a little unclear as to how a trial like this advances the field. I think that was my disappointment. Does it show that you can use either regimen? Yes, Point Break had already shown some of that, although in Point Break, both arms had Bev. So I wasn't sure what the intent of this trial was. If it was to demonstrate that you don't need Bev in first line, and I think that that triggers other questions, or if it was just to show that the toxicity profile of the two frequently used regimens are somewhat comparable. I wasn't sure as what the intent of the trial was.
So actually, I thought it was kind of cool. I'm going to give you my outsider view of this, but first, let's get the Point Break data out on the table, and then I'll tell you, I think, maybe how clinicians might view these two presentations. But you want to talk about, I guess, Mark Sosinski presented more data from Point Break. Can you remind us what that was looking at, what we'd seen before, and then what we saw now?
Okay. So Mark Sosinski presented the elderly subset analysis of Point Break. So Point Break was presented last year at the Chicago meeting by Jody Patel. And that trial was a very large phase 3 study looking at two regimens, the so-called Chicago regimen, which was carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab, and the maintenance in that arm was both PEM and BEV, versus, again, the ECOG regimen, carboplatin, paclitaxel, and BEV, with only BEV in the maintenance. And as we saw, the primary endpoint of that trial was overall survival, and there was no difference between the two regimens. There are some questions as to the maintenance component of that trial, and I think it would be useful to wait for more mature follow-up. But certainly with respect to the induction phase or the induction regimens, there was no significant difference. There was a slightly numerical difference that I believe even reached statistical significance in terms of PFS.
Progression for survival with the PEM.
But it was really not clinically meaningful. So I think what that trial showed was you can use either regimen. You know, toxicities were, again, not significantly different between the two. So what Mark did this time is he looked at elderly patients. And in fact, what I really liked about this trial was that it showed two subsets, you know, the ones that were over the age of 70, and then he separated out the over the age of 75.
Yeah, according to Antonio Palumbo in myeloma, it's the 75 or the very elderly.
No, absolutely. And I think that that's a concept that we're trying to also promote in non-small cell lung cancer. You know, a 74-year-old,
80.
Yeah, a 74-year-old nowadays, you know, without significant comorbidities, is really not different than a 68-year-old, you know, in many ways. A 78-year-old and certainly an 82-year-old may be slightly different. And I think we saw some of that. So going back to the trial, so the endpoints were the same. There was no difference in the elderly versus the younger subset. And then even between the older than 70 and then the older than 75, there were no significant differences. The overall survival, however, was numerically slightly lower in the over 75 subset. And again, I don't know how much you can make out of that because it wasn't statistically significant.
Do we know cancer-related death as opposed to non?
We don't know that. We don't know
that. Over 75, it should be starting to come up a little bit.
Yes.
So, okay, here's why I think these two papers actually are really good.
Okay.
So the first thing, the Point Break elderly paper, the thing that I saw about it was it looked like these patients toxicity-wise did fine with Bev. Age 70, age 75. I see lots of people not using Bev in older people. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure I've seen it. Maybe there's other data that's, you know, looked at this. But I was struck by how well these people did, these older people did with Bev.
Yeah. So I think that's a very important point. And, you know, we had some concerns about the use of Bev in elderly patients. This came out of 4599 and then the JAMA paper that came from the Dana-Farber. So I think it's a great point that you raised that some people in practice do not like to use Bev in elderly patients. And I think that this trial showed that you can, you know, with reasonable toxicity, that it's no different than younger patients.
You know, on last Saturday night at ASCO, we were doing a colorectal program. Mm-hmm. And we had docs, as always, we have docs in practice presenting patients, and this guy presents a 71-year-old, and the patient got FOLFOX without Bev. And I'm like, well, why didn't you use Bev? Mm-hmm. No real reason, no cardiovascular morbidity, just 71.
Yeah.
People pull back. The other thing, looking at these two trials, I know the researchers were trying to understand more what's better, you know, the science of it, but more from a macro perspective, you didn't see like a huge difference between several different alternatives.
Yeah. I'm still a little reluctant to conclude, at least for all patients, that a regimen that does not contain Bev is the same as a regimen that contains Bev. In other words, if we go that route, then we're basically saying, you know, Bev doesn't add that much to chemo. And I'm not quite prepared to do that.
You know, the other thing is our CME group kind of sometimes comes at it the other way, whereas we go, okay, well, there's all these data presented, et cetera, et cetera. But like, well, what do you all do? So, you know, you tell me what we find out when we ask 10 or 30 lung cancer investigators, what tends to be the strategy that you use in pan wild type metastatic adenocarcinoma? And I'll tell you what we found, but you tell me, what do you think people are doing? What do you do?
So I usually treat patients with carboplatin, pemetrexed, and usually with Bev.
And a lot of people do that. It kind of seems like more investigators do that. Mm-hmm. And then you still have the 4599 people, you know, who are heavily involved with ECOG. And, you know, not that they're biased in any way, but it is a reasonable alternative. Mm-hmm. Maybe not quite as many people doing that, but a fair number. And then I guess the other issue is, what do you do when you have somebody with an adenocarcinoma? You just don't want to use Bev. They might have had a recent cardiovascular event. How do you approach them?
So I think carbo-pem is a reasonable alternative, and we saw that in this trial, or you can use a carbo and a taxane.
And what about the maintenance?
So if I start with a pem-based regimen, I usually continue the pem. If I have both pem and bev in the induction regimen, so to speak, then I also continue both in the maintenance.
Interesting. Yeah.